Thank you. Thank you for the invitation. It's nice to be here today. And I guess when you give a title like this, you have to sort of ask yourself, is there a flying leap involved? And the answer is yes. And then, of course, you have to ask yourself, well, what happens on the other side of the leap? And you hope the answer is not a splat, but it may very well be. The presentation here really is sort of ideas-driven, I guess you could say. And I'm going to draw on some ideas that I've developed sort of on an empirical basis from work that we've done at the Duke FACE site. It's an elevated CO2 experiment where we can look at these interesting interactions between the carbon cycle and the nitrogen cycle. And I think within the context of this experiment, then, we can begin to address these kinds of issues. And then, of course, it stands to reason, well, if it applies at one place, it should apply everywhere. And if it does, great. If it doesn't, why not? Because the heterogeneity in that result ultimately is what we really care about when we're thinking about linking enzyme activities with very large-scale questions of carbon balance, whether at a stand scale, a regional scale, or the global scale. Because as Matt pointed out in his presentation, it's the enzymes that are doing all the work that are decomposing that soil organic matter, feeding back directly to CO2 emissions in the Earth's atmosphere, but also releasing nutrients that we know are important to primary production. So that's sort of the flavor of the talk as I'm going to give it today. And, of course, when you're talking about large collaborative projects such as the Duke FACE site, you have to include your collaborators. These are only two of the collaborators that have kind of most contributed to the conceptual development and empirical development of the work that I propose today, but there's a host of other folks as well. And also, we enjoy continuous support from the Department of Energy to run this experiment and have had some support from the National Science Foundation as well to support this research. So just to put this into a broader context, obviously nitrogen limitation is a widespread ecological phenomenon, and the basis for that limitation was very well laid out in a paper back in 1991 by Peter Vitusek and Bob Howarth, sort of providing the underpinnings for why nitrogen limitation is so pervasive in the terrestrial biosphere. And I won't go through all those reasons, but suffice it to say that if you do a meta-analysis here by David LeBauer and Kathleen Treseder, and you sort of synthesize the response of non-managed terrestrial ecosystems to nitrogen fertilization, in general, there's a pretty consistent increase. This response ratio, any value greater than one, indicates a stimulation in productivity among these different ecosystems in response to additions of nitrogen fertilization. So nitrogen limitation is widespread, and obviously enzymes have a big impact on the rate at which plants can acquire nitrogen from the soils. So moving from this very simple kind of idea that nitrogen limitation is widespread, I think it's useful to think about then what the role of nitrogen limitation may be in terms of the carbon cycle of the terrestrial biosphere. And again, I'm going to do that from the perspective of elevated CO2 experiments. What's very interesting about these elevated CO2 experiments is that they don't all respond similarly. This is sort of a graphic, if you will, sort of providing a pictorial representation of the range of responses that we see in terms of the stimulation and net primary production when you all of a sudden increase atmospheric CO2 concentrations to 550 or 700 ppm, roughly double or slightly double ambient, or slightly less than double ambient CO2 concentrations. And these ecosystems are arrayed from those that show essentially no loss of stimulation and net primary production to an increase in elevated CO2 alone, to those that show a transient response, to those that show, in fact, no response to elevated CO2 alone. And what's interesting about these particular sets of ecosystems is that these are all ecosystems in which we know something about the nature of nitrogen limitation. With the exception of the top two on the left-hand side, all the other ecosystems are ecosystems where nutrient amendments, nitrogen additions, very clearly show that the system is nitrogen limited. So within the context of nitrogen limitation as a pervasive sort of ecological force, we can see really wide variations in the responses of ecosystems to elevated CO2, which means that there has to be some level of interaction that's going on below ground to help explain that diversity of response. Just to provide a little bit more meat to this argument, let me just show you a few of the data slides that you can bring to bear to demonstrate this variation in ecosystem responses. I'm starting from a sort of bottom right up to the top left. These are some results from the sea trees. This is a southeastern coastal plain loblolly pine open top chamber experiment where they fumigated forest trees in these sort of large plastic bags with double ambient CO2. And if you look at the top bar chart on the left-hand side, you can see that there's no response in diameter growth or the amount of carbon that's accumulated in the woody biomass in response to elevated CO2 in the absence of nitrogen fertilization. So this is a system where nitrogen limitation is pretty strong, or in fact maybe severe, you could say, and there's simply no response to elevated CO2 alone. And then we can now march up along that diagram. This is a figure from the BioCon experiment. This is a CO2 by biological diversity by nitrogen fertilization treatment. This is taking place at the Cedar Creek Natural History Area, which is a part of the University of Minnesota system. And let's see, do I have a laser pointer anywhere? Oh, the mouse? Oh, I see. Well, I can maybe just walk over here. So if you look at the pattern of plant biomass production under ambient versus elevated CO2 in the absence of nitrogen fertilization, you're comparing these open circles with the filled circles here. And what you can see for the BioCon experiment is that for the first 3 years of CO2 treatment, there's a significant increase in plant biomass under elevated CO2 compared to ambient CO2. But then after the fourth year, that effect essentially drops away. But what's interesting is because they had the nitrogen manipulation in this particular experiment, you can also then compare these dynamics to responses to CO2 where nitrogen essentially isn't limiting. That would be the filled triangles here. And in that case, you can see that there's the maintenance of the CO2 response. So this is very clearly a nitrogen-driven decrease in the productivity of this Minnesota grassland under elevated CO2. The following figure is a figure that comes from the Oak Ridge National Lab Forest Free Air CO2 Enrichment Experiment. And the dynamics here, again, are just sort of spreading the time. If you look at the top plot, it's net primary production under ambient CO2, which is the bottom sort of yellow line, and elevated CO2, which is the top green line. And if you look for the first sort of 6 or 7 years of CO2 fumigation, you can see that net primary production is significantly higher under elevated CO2. But then after sort of 2005, 2006, through 2009, there's no longer a response of net primary production to elevated CO2. And again, this can be tied into nitrogen limitation. This is the pattern of foliar nitrogen concentrations through time. And when you map foliar nitrogen concentrations through time as a function of net primary production, you can see two slopes, an initial stimulation in net primary productivity under elevated CO2. But because foliar nitrogen concentrations through time are going in this particular direction, you can see that these two slopes are converging. Again, providing perhaps not an explicit, but a inferential relationship with nitrogen availability in the soil in the case of the Oak Ridge National Lab face site. The Duke face site where I work, and which will serve as the model sort of moving forward for the balance of this talk, is a system where net primary production seems to be stimulated in the long term in response to elevated CO2. These data go through 2005, but they continue through today. We very clearly see a continuation in the stimulation of NPP in the absence of fertilization, and we just had some results in this morning showing that in a fertilization experiment at this site, we also see the continuation of nitrogen limitation in the sense that when you add fertilizers to these plots, all of a sudden, you know, you do see a very strong CO2 by nitrogen interaction, again, pinpointing this important relationship between those two resources. And at the Duke face site, we've had lots of climate extremes, droughts and ice storms and all kinds of nasty things that happen during the course of long-term experiments. And even in the face of all that variability, we do see this continued stimulation in net primary production. So when we look at this diversity of ecosystem responses, then the problem as it sort of stands right now is that there's really no good sort of framework for thinking about why it is that in all these nitrogen-limited systems we observe this diversity in ecosystem responses to high CO2. And this is where I'm going to make the leap, that I think that what's going on here is a really important set of interactions between the carbon and nitrogen cycles below ground, and that what we really need to be doing is focusing on those below-ground processes with enzymes figuring in a very prominent way. I think that one of the things that I've found interesting as I've delved into this is that there's not enough interaction, I think, between the thoughts of plant below ground carbon allocation and the functioning of microbial communities. We typically think of microbial communities as simply decomposing soil organic matter, but that's definitely not true. Below ground carbon allocation by plants is the second largest carbon flux in most terrestrial ecosystems. It's second to gross primary production. So there's a huge flux of carbon that's going below ground. Some of that is used to support root production and maintenance respiration in live roots, but a lot of that carbon is also being allocated to mycorrhizal fungi that are in the soils, as well as released into the environment through the process of root exudation. And those represent important carbon subsidies to microbial processes. So what I'd like to do today is, I think, make the case that this interaction between below-ground carbon allocation and its sort of feedback effects on microbial communities that involves enzymes is a really important tool in thinking about why, at the ecosystem scale, we observe this diversity in CO2 responses to elevated CO2. It's pretty clear. I guess I have a question mark by bullet point number two. Do increases in below-ground carbon allocation increase nutrient uptake by the vegetation? I think the answer is yes, but what's become sort of interesting as we move forward is whether is sort of understanding the degree to which that occurs. In some systems, that may be very efficient. A little carbon gets you a bunch of nitrogen. In other systems, some carbon may get you very little nitrogen, and that's really what we need to begin exploring. So here's just a picture of the total below-ground carbon flux under ambient and elevated CO2 as a function of nitrogen availability in the soil, in this case 2 molar KCl extractable inorganic nitrogen, for the elevated CO2 experiment at the Duke Face site. And as you might expect, plants are making very wise decisions about how much carbon to allocate below ground as a function of perceived nutrient stress or even nutrient demand. As soil nitrogen concentrations go up, below ground carbon fluxes go down. And this isn't unique to this site. This has been observed in very many different kinds of sites. What's interesting here, though, is that the flux per unit of the flux of carbon below ground per unit of sort of available nitrogen in the soil is significantly higher under elevated CO2, and that probably reflects the fact that these plants have more carbon, and so they can allocate a little bit more below ground. They also have higher nutrient demands because this system is one where the increase in net primary production is driven by increases in nitrogen uptake, not by increases in nitrogen use efficiency. So what's going on then? Well, obviously this carbon is being allocated below ground, but there's two really important sets of things that happen beyond just producing more roots and scavenging for whatever nitrogen may be available in a nitrogen-limited system, which is arguably low. One is the release of that carbon to mycorrhizal fungi. Mycorrhizal fungi are symbionts where plants exchange carbon for water and nutrients from that symbiont. And there are certain groups that are very well known to be very important to nitrogen acquisition. Those are ectomycorrhizal fungi. The Duke Face site where I work is a system where the pines and the hardwoods are largely ectomycorrhizal. And they have these very interesting sort of life history strategies as a fungus. This central stalk here is just a fungal hyphae. And from that hyphae, these fungi can release mucopolysaccharides, which essentially envelop portions of the soil organic matter. And within that envelope can release enzymes, phenol oxidases, peroxidases, lactases that decompose relatively labile components of soil organic matter, but are also nitrogen-bearing components of soil organic matter, as well as protease enzymes, which we know can attack proteinaceous materials in the soil, which are in relatively high concentrations in most ecosystems. So to the extent that plants are subsidizing mycorrhizal activity by releasing them from carbon limitation, they may be able to synthesize additional quantities of these different kinds of extracellular enzymes, attack the soil organic matter, and then reabsorb that mucopolysaccharide directly into the hyphae, which means that the investment in the enzymes by the fungus is very efficient. They're taking in the products of the activities of those enzymes when that mucopolysaccharide is reabsorbed. Are you standing because I'm running out of time? How much time do I have?
One more minute.
How many?
One more minute.
One more minute. Okay. Well, I'm not going to get to it very then. So here's one really important process. The other process is root exudation, and I guess I can move through this a little bit quicker than I had thought. This is a sort of first, if you will, measurement of the total quantity of carbon that's leaving roots in an ecosystem. This is done by Rich Phillips. And what we see here very clearly is that there's significant increases in rates of root exudation into the mycorrhizosphere under elevated CO2. And that elicits a big change in extracellular enzyme activities. If you look in midsummer, you can see significant increases in proteolytic enzyme capacities and a tendency towards increases in lignolytic enzyme activities in these rhizosphere soils that he and I have been studying in great detail. And that pattern is robust through time. If you look at, for example, 1 year later in July of 2009, here looking at the activity of N-acetylglucosaminidase, you can see that there are important differences in the rates of those enzymes between the bulk soil, the pair on the left, and the rhizosphere soils on the right. And in particular, under elevated CO2, the farthest right bar, you can see that elevated CO2 significantly increases the activity of that enzyme. So I'm going to move quickly now to the end and make the case, now hoping not to splat, that what essentially we're talking about here is a marketplace. A marketplace where plants are allocating carbon below ground and are actively modifying microbial activity. They can't modify microbial activity infinitely plastically, but they can to a certain degree by allocating this carbon and affecting microbial resource limitation, perhaps accelerating nitrogen or phosphorus limitation over carbon limitation, which feeds back through enzyme production and the decomposition of soil organic matter. This model would work very well for the Duke Face site. It's a place where we've seen these sets of feedbacks occurring. And in fact, that feedback seems to sustain net primary production in response to elevated CO2 alone in a nitrogen-limited system. This model, however, obviously applies very heterogeneously. Think about all the other experiments that I mentioned a little bit earlier. They didn't respond sort of over the long term in terms of NPP in response to high CO2, which means then that there's going to be limits to where this model applies. There's going to be places where this works very well, and there's places where this doesn't work well. And we have to understand how and why that's the case. And it's probably related to things like the chemistry of soil organic matter, the composition of the microbial community, and the total quantities of carbon that are being allocated below ground. So this is sort of a hypothesis for thinking about the way that we might link in, ultimately, enzyme activities to terrestrial or regional, regional, global scale fluxes of carbon, and is one that I think we ought to be thinking about as we kind of move forward. So I'll have to stop there. Thank you.